and welcome to Igniting Scale. In today's episode, we have the privilege of hosting Glenn Mercer, a researcher in the automotive industry with a career that spans over three decades. Glenn is renowned for his work with the oil industry and the CIA, but also is an ex-McKinsey partner. I'm an avid viewer of his work on car charts via Substack, and that's a must-see, and his links are available in the show notes. His deep knowledge of the US and global automotive markets will give us a unique perspective on how the industry will play out, which is essential for founders looking to scale their businesses in the future. Glenn, welcome to Ignite and Scale. It's an honor to have you on, and it's always great to have a conversation with you about the intricacies of the automotive world. Perhaps before we dive in, though, into a couple of questions I have for you, perhaps you could share a little bit about your journey and how your experiences have shaped your view on the industry growth and adaptation.
Okay. I have available a DVD of my childhood I could pop in, but we'll skip that and fast forward to the freshly minted MBA. The best job offer I had was from what your audience would know as British Petroleum, but at the time was SOHIO, the Ohio branch of BP, and started out working in retail planning there, gas stations and things. Along the way, yes, I think you already outed me to your audience. I did work for the Central Intelligence Agency, but as far as I know, didn't shoot anybody. I was using satellite photography to count rail cars full of Soviet grain. Anyway, went over to McKinsey, was there 21 years, left as a partner. The last 15 years there, I was specialized in automotive, especially in downstream automotive. As the old joke goes, the car companies make cars, everybody else makes money. From left there in 2006, I've been independent ever since. Since I was a consultant there, I'm a researcher now. Too many late nights in obscure hotel rooms with empty pizza boxes to do any more consulting. But I do research. I have done VC, venture capital work, private equity work, been on the boards of a few companies, including the late lamented Rimstock in sunny West Bromwich. They have reorganized and are still going, making wheels for Aston Martin and McLaren and things like that, but certainly not due to any brilliant management ideas I had. And most recently, over the last 10 years now, I think I've now 11 years in a row, I've done at least one project a year for the National Auto Dealers Association, NADA, in the United States. And that's where a lot of any of my comments today will come from, is that work. Though the disclaimer is, these are my own points, not the official word of NADA. So that's the story. And I like the automotive industry because it's so incredibly varied.
No, it certainly is. And every year we speak, there's always a new story to tell as well. But I guess looking ahead in the automotive industry, like many others, it is on the cusp of so many transformational changes. And Glenn, given, you know, your experience and the work that you've done, What are some of your predictions for the future, and how do you think businesses can kind of prepare to capitalize on some of these impending changes we see?
Okay, well, so it's crystal ball time. And the first thing here is to be humble. Whenever I think I'm any good at predicting the future, I look back at Chrysler and its journey through being owned by Mercedes, Daimler, by a private equity firm, by Fiat, kind of bailing Fiat out, then turning around and getting bailed out by Fiat, and is now part of a company from Luxembourg called Stellantis. None of this makes any sense at all, and none of it can ever be predicted, so one has to be humble. But I do bring one thing for sure to this discussion, which is that I'm 68. And so, as you point out, we're on the cusp of change. We've always been on the cusp of change. It's something that sort of a every NADA annual convention, whether in New Orleans or Las Vegas or whatever, there's a new burning topic. Last year, it maybe was starting to be agency. This year, electric vehicles. And then, you know, 5 years ago, it was autonomous vehicles. It was mobility services like Uber, maybe 4 years ago. You go back to 2000, it was publicly traded dealerships would destroy private dealerships. So there's been a whole rotating cast of characters and challenges. I would say at this point in time, from an American perspective, and I know I'm talking to a British audience, I was just in London a couple of weeks ago, as a matter of fact, never have I seen more Lamborghinis driven more slowly than in the West End of London. All those Ferraris that have never shifted out of first gear. It's amazing. Anyway, this year, I'd say from an American perspective, the question is, what is the new normal? As we went through COVID and the chip shortages, we realized that maybe we were underpricing cars for many years as we saw people lining up with bags of cash to buy cars. Our prices went through the roof and they started to come back down. The question is, will they go all the way back down? Will inventories build all the way back up? Will incentives go all the way back up? And we're back to where we were in 2019, which was not a bad place to be. But at the peak of the shortages, the average dealership was probably pulling down $6 million pre-tax. In 2019, probably $2 million. And so now we're sort of coasting back down. The question is, do we coast all the way down? I'm hoping, I don't think it's a forecast, but I'm hoping we maybe coast down to a little better than we were, maybe 2.5, 2.8 million. We shall see.
Fascinating. I guess in the States, I mean, obviously, you know, we do have different types of change. So obviously the UK, there's been a lot more about agency, less so in the US, given the role and order, et cetera. And maybe we've adopted electrification slightly ahead of the American market as well. So maybe in the UK, we've seen faster change than in the US. And, you know, that's each market has its own intricacies, I guess.
Yeah, though I would say, and I'm no expert on the UK market, but certainly the structure of your contracts and things are such that it makes it easier for the car company to sort of apply muscle to change and maybe to agency and things like that. But I do note Ford recently reversed direction on agency in Europe. So I wonder where we'll sort out.
Not the only one.
Yeah. It makes sense to me for luxury cars to some extent. I'm less sure. Well, put it another way. Whenever demand is greater than supply, you can sell any way you want. You could auction them off, drop them from blimps, you know, whatever. But when supply becomes greater than demand, I think the dealership network steps back in. And I think right now each OEM is trying to figure out where they fine tune that. Because as you know, agency is not defined in the dictionary. There's a lot of different flavors of it for sure. So we shall see. But it has cooled off in the United States. And then, yeah, as you point out, electric vehicles have always been, America not only has more issues with distance and things like that, but we have politicized EVs like we politicize everything. So that's added another twist.
Yeah, I mean, I think in our view, EV is one solution, but not the final solution. I'm sure synthetic fuels, hydrogen will all play a future role in various applications of whether that's commercial vehicles or
maybe. Yeah, I think the phrase "horses for courses" works for me, which is, you know, heavy duty, what you would call Arctics, you know, diesel, maybe for a long, long time. Or urban delivery vans should have been electric probably 20 years ago, plug-in hybrids, regular hybrids, et cetera. But, you know, I don't know about the UK, but in the United States, there's kind of this winner-take-all mentality. So either EVs are good or EVs are bad, and there's not much room in between. One of our leading presidential candidates, his Christmas greetings to proponents of EVs were, and I quote, "May they rot in hell," unquote, a direct quote from Donald J. Trump, which I wonder what he meant by that. Anyway, so we have this odd situation of we face the same things you face. How many chargers are there? Will the grid stand up to this? How much does it cost? But the extra problem of, depending on what happens in November, we might see massive policy changes.
No, I think I remember you pointing out some of these factors in 2019, pre-COVID, that just the practicalities of some of these solutions was things to consider, which haven't really been considered. That it just gets rolled out as a, as you say, a winner takes all kind of scenario, which is seems to be the world we live in now.
Yeah, it's kind of weird in the automotive industry. I talk to other retail industries periodically, trying to learn from outside automotive, and they are they tend to be perplexed that we don't pilot things much. We seem to kind of go crazy. I remember, you know, if you go back 10 years ago to the Frankfurt Auto Show, diesels were everywhere. I don't know where the diesels all went. I guess we, but anyway, sorry, I'm rambling on. Go ahead.
It was the environmental solution then, wasn't it? Those years ago, 20 years ago, it was the environmental solution. So these solutions changed, didn't they? Yeah. As always, Glenn, you know, fascinating insights. But perhaps, you know, if we pivoted into businesses today, especially in the automotive sector, but also kind of startup businesses as well, from your experience, what do you think are the main factors startup or early stage businesses need to keep ahead of to kind of, you know, hit their business plans and to achieve growth? What are the most interesting areas do you think early stage businesses should focus on?
Right. Okay. Well, if we take that, because, you know, many dealers, such as in the UK, they'll say they've been around since, you know, Churchill or older. So, if we leave the dealers aside and we talk about maybe, and the used car startups have had kind of a rough patch, so it might pass over them. But so if I take, let's just take software and IT. You know, I don't know what the number is in the UK, but the average dealership in the United States is probably spending $20,000 to $30,000 a month on software and IT. Remember, our average store is about $70 million in revenue dollars. So it's a big, attractive market. You multiply that by 12 months and by 18,000 stores, and it's a big target. And so if we look at startups and innovation in automotive retailing in the United States, it is in this vendors of software services, software as a service, mobility services, et cetera. I think if I were giving advice, easy for me, I've never started a business other than my own, where my only other employee is my chief security officer, who's a dog. So what am I talking about? But I would say a incredibly clear and simple selling proposition if you're selling into automotive retail. If you can't say it in about 8 words, it's probably too long. Because again, I don't know the UK situation, but in the United States, the average dealer has got anywhere from 10 to 30 software vendors. And they're all selling the latest CRM, this, that, the other thing. And they're all promising 10% productivity gains. So as one dealer joked with me, if I sign up with 10 of them, my expenses will fall to zero for the entire store, because each give me a 10% gain. It doesn't quite work that way. But I'd say a really clear value proposition that has you stand out from the crowd. And, you know, to be really, really good on your calculations, because I don't want to say that software and IT has disappointed the industry. That's maybe too harsh. But the rate of improvement, I don't think, has really been what we had hoped. Now, so for example, again, I'm sorry I keep repeating this, but I don't want to be a resident of the colonies lecturing the imperial headquarters here. In 1985, when I did my first piece of dealership consulting, 10 new cars retailed per salesperson per month was thought to be about right. And if I go forward 50 years, it's still kind of about 10, maybe 11 or 12, depending if you've got a BDC or a lead aggregator. And I go, we've been throwing IT at this problem for a long, long time. And I don't know why it hasn't gotten traction. Now, there might be reasons for it, like, well, the sales pitch has become more complicated, it takes more time, et cetera, et cetera. But that's an example. Another example is advertising. All the way through this shortage period we were just discussing, American new car dealers kept up advertising spending at about $600, $700 per new car retailed. And you go, why? You know, if everything they had, they could sell within days, why are we what prevents us from being able to claw that money back? Because, you know, if someone's driving in from Heathrow past that galactic Audi dealership, which must be the size of Einstein, you know, do they need to be told Audi sells cars? So that's another black hole there of Salesforce productivity. If somebody could crack that code, that'd be incredible. Again, maybe you've cracked it in the UK. Advertising spend, and we were sort of kind of promised that we could tie the leads back to the click, you know, upstream somewhere. And so when we did all that, we know exactly where our customers found us, and so we wouldn't have to shell out for advertising anymore, but we do. So so on the one hand, as you point out, enormous amount of change, enormous number of vendors, enormous amount of development. Heck, Lithia from the United States just bought a firm, a chain of dealers in the UK that gives them a DMS system. Really, you know, it's been a little, okay, I will go out and say it's been a little disappointing. So I'd say a really clear value proposition, selling proposition, and maybe try to tackle some of these core big questions. I don't think it's one more CRM application is the answer out there, but you know, that's my rant. That's my rant.
I think Glenn is ever, you know, really, really on point, because it's exactly how we see it in the UK at the moment as well. There's some good businesses, but they've got to change the dial and prove a return. And I think the thing that I've discovered in the last few months as well is the system has to talk to the other systems. Integration has to be seamless, because the current car dealer has got logins for 20 odd different systems, whether that's OEM enforced systems or other software systems. And to get the power of the data and to claw the dollars back, as you say, the systems all have to kind of talk to each other and provide that extra intelligence to provide that return, really. And if it stands on its own and doesn't provide any information, then it's easy to switch off. So as ever, I think you're kind of spot on in terms of your analysis of the situation. And I guess in the UK, whilst the UK and the US market, that there's obviously some big differences there. There's some core similarities, as we've seen with, you know, how used car dealers have fared and disruptors, et cetera. It's the thing for me is selling cars is never straightforward. It's complex, and people haven't given the franchise model that's been around over 100 years enough credit. I don't know what you think of that.
I agree. I think that's one reason why, you know, if I go back to 18,000 stores, $20,000 a month multiplied through, why haven't we seen more of the really big software companies go into automotive? Again, maybe in Europe, Microsoft has a DMS somewhere, or, you know, or something like, or SAS does or something. But in the United States, the only really new entrant in the big DMS side has been Tekion, which is sort of a bunch of Tesla refugees. And I think one of the challenges is, well, two of the challenges, I think you've touched on both of them. One of them is this integration thing. You'd say, this is a huge target. Why don't you build the software and fix this? And I think part of it is, as you point out, I've got to attach so many bells and whistles and cover so much ground. It's really complicated. And I mean, arguably, automotive retail is, I don't know, healthcare, so leave healthcare out. But automotive retail has to be one of the most complicated retail businesses in the world. You know, new cars have their own key performance indicators. Used cars entirely different. Parts is inventory management. Service is figuring out how to utilize technicians. Collision repair. So maybe it's just integrating all that stuff. Like you point out, you have to integrate it all, because no dealer wants to be retyping and re-entering data all over the place. But nobody gets paid for integration. You know, it will say, I want your system to integrate these other applications, but I won't pay you for it. It might be part of it. The other part is, as you hinted at, and I think this is what has kept like Amazon out for so long, is the transaction's never simple. You know, out of 100 car sales, 100 of them are unique. It just drives me crazy. But, you know, it is click, click, click kind of thing. And so that maybe that's maybe software's great advantage is it standardizes stuff, and it's just hard to standardize stuff in automotive. You know, the trade-in was worth this much on Friday, it's worth this much on Monday, but I didn't get the check until Tuesday, and just, you know, endless stuff like that. So yeah, it's still a mess.
We'll find more complexities and problems for companies to solve. But as ever, it's always great talking to you and just understanding where you are and how you see US market and UK. So really appreciate your time this afternoon. Thank you, Glenn.
Sure, no problem. My closing remarks would be I'm still bullish on the industry. If only because of 25 years of another asteroid about to hit us or something, I guess I'll close with one comment. Every year we're told that customers are deeply dissatisfied. And every year when I look at the actual statistics, at least in the States from JD Power and other sources, I see customer satisfaction going up. So I can only conclude that's what happens. And I'm sure you have the same effect in the UK. You probably call it MP effect, which is all politicians are crooks except for my MP. He or she, that's the exception, right? You know, so we have this drumbeat of the retail system is broken, whatever, dealers are all crooks or villains. And then you say, well, how were your last five car purchases? Oh, they were wonderful. So, you know, so hang in there, guys. You're doing better than I think the zeitgeist or the buzz in the atmosphere would say. And I think I don't know if you'll be here for another 125 years, but I'll go for at least another quarter century.
At least, Glenn, that's great to end a great night to end on. And thank you again.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me, and have a great day.
If you want to listen to more episodes of the podcast, we're on all good audio platforms. Our website is also www.cambriaprivatecapital.com. And you can also find myself on LinkedIn and Twitter, where we publish our weekly blogs as well. Please do get in touch if you want more information.